directly on, quote, honorable men for his work and likes the company of, quote, leaders, including Abu Nidal, who would fly with him. Presumably meaning he would fly, that they would share a private jet together. Anyway, so rather interesting connections again between Adnan Roussan, this Jordanian arms dealer, Peter Ali, a high-ranking Reagan administration official, and contact between, and thereby being another conduit for shipping arms to yet another provocative Arab group, namely Khomeini's Iranian government.
And again, we have Adnan Roussan associated, according to that article, not only with Adnan Khashoggi, who we deal with, also with Abu Nidal, Peter Ali, and that he has admitted in so many terms, in so many words, that he in fact was selling arms to Khomeini on behalf of the United States. This is why we say that it now appears that Italy's Iran gate and our Iran gate are part of the same situation. And again, the contacts between Reagan White House people and Abu Nidal are as ominous as they are astounding. More on Abu Nidal, Adnan Roussan, and Adnan Khashoggi. Again, research credit and translation credit to the same listener. This is from La Repubblica of March 2nd of 1987, Dateline Rome. Sometime in 1985, Abu Nidal, the big chief of the Middle Eastern terrorism in Italy, came to Italy. Khashoggi was the one to request the meeting between them. The request originated from aboard the Nabila, and all of the telexes sent from the Nabila somehow ended up in Roussan's house in Verona. Most likely it was Roussan's job to set up the meetings. Roussan was being investigated for this matter and many others, but a few days after his release he disappeared. He probably went back to Jordan. The investigation on Roussan and the arms traffic continues at a national level, followed by the Secret Service's investigation for the international implication, which seems to become more and more fascinating and revealing. The messages originated from the Nabila and issued to Roussan were many. In 1985 alone, he set up many meetings in Paris for Ben Bella and Peter Ali, another high-level exponent of American traffic and very close to Reagan himself. The reason for the meetings was to set up a supply of arms for the Jordanian and Algerian markets. Roussan had contacts also with Günther, a powerful German arms smuggler known as a chief mediator for the arms supply between Syria and France. Roussan and Günther talked about big deals of 105 cannons and electronic furnishings for military equipment, and the delivery was to be accomplished through planes and ships addressed to Mr. Yasser, identified as the leader of the PLO, Arafat. And again, the link here between people close to the Reagan administration, such as Peter Ali, people like Abu Nidal and Adnan Roussan and Adnan Khashoggi, well, the implications, we just couldn't exaggerate. And again, what we're asking is whether some of these terrorist groups are being manipulated for the purpose of provocation.
Again, talking about further connections between, we mentioned all the provocative acts carried out by Ottfried Hepp and his strange and motley crew, including a lot of bombing of American military installations and places frequented by American military personnel, oftentimes with the help to neo-Nazi Hepp of left-wing organizations. We're going to talk about some other folks also connected to Adnan Roussan and their connections to some very similar bombings taking place. Remember, Adnan Roussan apparently working with Peter Ali on behalf of the United States government, shipping arms to Khomeini. At the same time, Adnan Roussan himself running with people like Abu Nidal, Adnan Khashoggi, and as we'll see, probably the people who were involved with the LaBelle discotheque bombing that injured several people and killed a couple. This is from La Repubblica for February 3rd, 1987. First part, Dateline, Genova. Judge Paolo Martinelli has requested the release of two prisoners for insufficient evidence. They are Auni Hindawi, 25 years old, a student of political science in Genova, and Adnan Roussan, age 40, officially the manager of an import-export company in Verona, but in reality an arms smuggler. Hindawi was arrested last June during the trial on the hijacking of the Kile Lauro. Roussan was arrested in his house a few days later. Other Jordanians were released earlier. During the course of the inquest, Luigi Carli, public prosecutor, came across many contradictions, such as a possible link between Hindawi and a terrorist network throughout Europe and possibly Italy. The other magistrate, Paolo Galizia, that followed up in the matter, however, found insufficient evidence to corroborate Carli's theory that Hindawi was plotting an ambush against the Italian government. The prisoners were released. However, they cannot leave the country. Hindawi must remain in Sassello, and Roussan must stay in Verona. Judge Martinelli said that even though they have been released, it does not mean there will not be more incriminating evidence against them. The inquest continues. Then, Dateline London, Auni Hindawi is a cousin of the two brothers, Nezar and Asi Hindawi. Auni was the contact in Italy for the organization, and Hasi in Berlin. A year ago, Nezar tried to plant a bomb on an El Al plane by hiding it in his girlfriend's bag. He got 45 years. In Berlin, Hasi bombed the offices of an Arab-German company and got 14 years. He is still awaiting trial for the bombing of the La Belle discotheque in Berlin, where two people died and 150 were injured, all of them Americans. Recently, the German magistrates interrogated Auni Hindawi about the discotheque bombing, suspecting he might have known something about it. It seems that Nezar, right after his arrest, wrote a letter to his cousin Auni asking for help to free him and his brother by setting up a mission in the Middle East to get hostages and request the exchange. Auni was arrested in order to put a stop to such plans. The inquest also discovered that Auni, along with two cousins, attended a training camp for terrorists in the Bekaa Valley. The instructors were followers of General El-Kuli, Assad's number two man. The discovery of the link between the Hindawi clan and the Syrian secret services, accused of having supplied the bombs for the London and Berlin incidents, have raised harsh reactions by the two governments. Auni Hindawi even went to Roussan's house in Verona to ask for arms. By Roussan's own admission, he sells arms with his government's approval, that's the Jordanian government. He even has dealings with Khashoggi to sell arms to Iran. As a matter of fact, when Roussan was arrested, he was entertaining a deputy of NATO, perhaps sent by Peter Alley, a big shot in NATO's secret services. So again, the connection not only between Adnan Roussan and the aforementioned, but also between Adnan Roussan and apparently the Hindawi clan involved with the El Al bombing attempt, the La Belle discotheque, I can't remember the name of the Arab-German firm they're referring to, but I remember the case. So a variety of rather interesting cases for these folks to crop up.
Interestingly enough, the La Belle discotheque bombing in Berlin, which was used as the pretext for attacking Gaddafi, has some neo-Nazi implications or connections lurking around the outside of it. Again, we can't say definitively just exactly what they are, but we'll read you the information and you can make of it what you will. Research credit on this also goes to a listener. This is from The Nation magazine, specifically The Nation issue of March 14th, 1987. It's an article by Norman Birnbaum, B-I-R-N-B-A-U-M. It's called Disco Bombers. Although the nation is belatedly awakening to the Reagan administration's systematic use of disinformation, the press has been reticent until now about the implications of an obvious aspect of the April raid on Libya. Not only the European public, but also governments and security agencies are openly skeptical about Reagan's claim to have proof that the Libyans were responsible for the April 5th bombing of a discotheque in West Berlin frequented by American soldiers. The permanent officials of the security services in West Berlin have been particularly outspoken. Who, if not the Libyans, arranged for the bomb that blew up the discotheque La Belle? I lived a few blocks from it and visited it well before the fatal evening. It was one of the few meeting places in the city for young Germans, American soldiers, many of them black, and Turks from the city's large immigrant community. Many of those who turn out in West Berlin to wave American flags when President Reagan comes to town are like many of their counterparts in the United States. They are full of racism and xenophobia. Their most recent hero was Heinrich Lümmer, L-U-M-M-E-R, a member of the city government dismissed a few days before the bombing. Known as the crude senator, city commissioners are termed senators, Lümmer is a particularly repugnant figure. A proponent of law and order, unquote, he added unashamed racism to his open authoritarianism. At one point, he declared that the nation's biological substance was threatened by immigration of the lesser races. He lost his job for a number of reasons. One was his blatant pandering to the traditions of 1933 through 45. Another was his implication in a large and continuing scandal involving builders and brothel keepers, bribes, and Berlin politicians. The immediate occasion was the disclosure that he had covertly financed the city's neo-Nazis to reward them for defacing social democratic election posters. This next paragraph explains something about the La Belle bombing. When Lümmer left, his supporters organized a street demonstration in his favor. Some newspapers predicted that law and order would break down. The disco explosion followed. It had multiple uses. We know what Reagan did with it. In West Berlin, city officials, on orders from the Allied garrison commanders, promptly set out to screen for terrorists at the border and on the streets, choosing Middle Easterners and other dark-skinned people for prolonged interrogation. While the usual fantasies about terrorism commanded attention, West Berlin's racists could enjoy the situation. Nothing precise emerges from these observations, but there is an interesting connection to the Middle East that does not run through Libya. Loomer had often traveled to Lebanon, an activity he explained by the closeness of his relations to the Christian Falange there. Perhaps his relations were purely commercial. It has been suggested that he dealt in arms and perhaps in drugs and prostitutes. We know that the Falangists worked with the CIA in developing their own kinds of terror in Beirut. We also know that no one can become interior senator in West Berlin, which is not part of the Federal Republic but an occupied city, without the concurrence of the Allied intelligence agencies. West Berlin is so full of secret services, Eastern and Western, that disinformation, espionage, and covert action of all kinds is the one remaining local growth sector in a period of economic constriction. Loomer, who began his career by smuggling people out of East Berlin and is perhaps not entirely without Eastern ties, is utterly at home in this sordid milieu. His record suggests that he is a man not overburdened with moral refinement. Although there is no hard evidence, perhaps one or another of the investigators of the Iran-Contra affair might think it worthwhile to see if there is a West Berlin connection. Loomer himself is serving in the new Bundestag as a deputy. So again, the circumstances surrounding the LaBel bombing are open to question. We don't pretend to have the definitive answer, but I think Birnbaum's thesis here that possibly it was a neo-Nazi act and that was portrayed or was misportrayed by, for political purposes by elements in this country and elsewhere is worth considering, in particular the Ottfried Hepp connection to the Achille Lauro hijacking and some of the other explicit fascist and Nazi connections on both sides of the Atlantic that we've already touched on.
That's right, and the explicit fascist connections to the Hindawi clan, who were among those implicated perhaps in the bombing of La Belle Discotheque. And we're going to read a little bit more about Adnan Roussan, another connection of the Hindawi clan that we've been talking about. And this is another article translated by one of our listeners from La Repubblica for November 25, 1986. In reply to the chamber's questioning, the Secretary of Council Giuliano Amato said that there should be a precise rule for, quote, the exact identification of those authorized to sell arms and adequate sanctions in the event of irregularities on the destination. There is one case in Italy being worked on by the magistrature from Geneva that so far has been on the margin of the inquest, and that is the case of the Jordan Revolutionary Movement, the Hindawi group responsible for the attempts in London, Berlin, and maybe others in Italy. During the inquest, a Jordanian, Adnan Roussan, officially an importer and exporter, but in reality an admitted arms smuggler for many years, claimed, quote, I was authorized by my government by whom I was employed, unquote. He came to Italy during the 1970s, enrolled at the University of Perugia, took literature for a while, and then switched to medicine. In 1972, he moved to Verona, where he met some Jordanians working there, and with them founded a company called Nabila Trading East, with headquarters in Amman and dealing in furniture, fabrics, and miscellaneous items. In little time, they opened franchises in Los Angeles, Paris, and Athens.
Again, it's worth noting that this is an individual with connections to the PLO, Abu Nidal, and obviously he's well connected with the American National Security Establishment, as the Khashoggi and Peter Alley connections indicate. He had a branch of his business, Nabila Trading, in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is not the Middle East.
Pretty soon, Roussan started traveling the world. The telexes originating from his offices, however, talked almost always about all kinds of arms from all kinds of countries, but mostly from the Middle East. His catalogs were full of hand grenades, bazookas, Kalashnikovs, machine guns, air missiles, and air-to-land missiles. There were also cannons, 105 cannons made by Otto Molara, the most modern and functional today. The catalogs even featured a line of warplanes made in Italy. According to certain sources, Roussan was even able to bring ships full of arms into the Mediterranean basin. At the present, the recipient of some shipments are unknown. The only recipient known so far is the Islamic Alliance for the Afghanistan Liberation. There are no indications that any shipment was sent to Iran, but it is not to be ruled out either. Roussan's contacts were mainly in the Middle East, especially with, quote, big names of international terrorism, such as Abu Nidal, Jibril, Abu Musa. Rusan was also a very shrewd man who had contacts with petty officers of Digos of Verona, to whom he would give hints of possible attempts to be made in Italy. When he was arrested, he was, quote, entertaining a NATO officer. Was this just a coincidence, or were they discussing a possible purchase of arms hidden in a base near Verona?
So again, the connection, and remember now, Adnan Rusan, the key link we're looking at, linked with Abu Nidal, admitted we're selling arms to Khomeini for the United States, specifically as acting in an official American capacity. And one of the things we looked at in our Mediterranean merry-go-round series was the large number of people who dropped dead when the investigations in Italy began pursuing any of the many tendrils in the strategy of tension. Although it's perhaps apocryphal under the circumstances, I think there's a death in connection with the Achille Lauro hijacking in Italy that should be borne in mind. This is from the San Francisco Sunday Examiner and Chronicle for July 26th of 1987. It's a small story, headlined, Lauro Figures Suicide. A Palestinian acquitted of minor charges in the 1985 hijacking of the Italian cruise liner Achille Lauro jumped to his death from his Rome apartment Saturday while police were trying to arrest him on a Syrian warrant for fraud. Police said his death was a suicide. The dead man was Said Mufak Gandura, G-A-N-D-U-R-A, 38, who said he was a colonel in the intelligence service of the Palestine Liberation Organization. The PLO denied that Gandura was a PLO official. Whether or not he had key information about any of the angles that we've been talking about, obviously is a matter of speculation. We thought that the death was worth taking note of. And again, the key point here being with the Abu Nidal connection, the Mansur al-Qasar connection to Abu Nidal, the Rusan connection to Abu Nidal, the connections of the Iran-Contra supply team to both of them, and with these other terrorist incidents, we're reflecting against the background of Rex 84 and asking, what's up, Doc?
Continuing and talking a little bit more about the secret team, their own selves, this is from the San Jose Mercury News for Sunday, March 8th, 1987. Excuse me. The article is headlined, C-Cord led secret counterterrorism unit. Retired Air Force officer bypassed official controls, inquiries show. What a surprise. The article is by Frank Grieve of the Mercury News Washington Bureau, datelined D.C. Retired Air Force Major General Richard Secord led an ultra-secret U.S. counterterrorism unit, authorized by President Reagan in 1984, and intended to bypass normal government controls, according to interviews and recent government investigations. In that role, Secord often dominated Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, the National Security Council aide generally depicted as the driving force behind the Iran-Contra affair, according to federal investigators and associates of both men. Memos released by the Tower Commission show that North frequently communicated with Secord, but rarely curbed, commanded, or controlled him. More often, the memos show that North simply asked his superiors to support Secord's views and proposals, particularly on trading arms to Iran for American hostages. Secord and his business partner, Los Gatos businessman Albert Hakim, were described by the Senate Intelligence Committee as, quote, almost co-equal lieutenants with North in the Iran-Contra affair. Skipping down. The secret anti-terrorist task force that Secord helped run was set up to report directly to the National Security Council at the White House, a former Secord associate at the Pentagon said. It was intended to take tough, quote, proactive approaches to terrorism, he said, bypassing what Reagan administration officials considered reluctant, slow, leak-prone bureaucracies at the State Department, CIA, and Defense Department. The idea for such a task force developed in informal discussions by administration officials in 82 and 83, the source said. President Reagan approved the arrangement on April 3, 1984, when he signed a National Security Decision Directive drafted by North, according to sources in the Pentagon. One essential part of the directive authorized the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, the Pentagon's version of CIA, to employ intelligence agents to collect information about terrorism. Unlike the CIA, the DIA is not required to report certain sensitive operations to Congress. According to the former associate, Secord, a fighter pilot and veteran air commando, led the anti-terrorist task force as one of a, quote, small group of government employees and consultants, experienced people from the Middle East and Southeast Asia, absolutely trustworthy, low-profile people who won't talk, quote, unquote. Skipping down. In another memo, North wrote that available resources for such an operation included, quote, one ISA officer in Beirut, unquote, although more could be infiltrated. The initials ISA probably refer to the Intelligence Support Activity, a secret U.S. counterterrorist commando unit that Secord helped organize in 1980. It was intended to improve U.S. counterterrorist capability after the failed mission to rescue U.S. hostages in Iran, according to congressional testimony. Secord, who had served in Iran from 1975 to 1978, was principal airlift planner for that ill-fated attempt. At least 13 of the roughly 30 officers and crewmen who helped airdrop arms to Contra rebels last year also took part in the attempted rescue of Tehran embassy hostages, according to interviews with the crewmen. The ISA was supposedly deactivated in 83, the same year Secord retired. A year later, the New York Times reported that the ISA was providing, quote, both equipment and personnel to the CIA for its covert operations in Central America, unquote. So, again, we see that, again, this rather strange combination of things, where on one hand we have this ultra-secret government within the government operation put together, the ISA, or whatever you want to call it, being run by Secord, containing a lot of the self-same people who somehow managed to be around when the Desert One rescue attempt went down, thus finally dispatching Jimmy Carter's presidential chances. The same group crops up at the same time as connections are being made between the Reagan administration and various Middle Eastern terrorist groups. There's a whole rash of terrorist attacks in the Middle East and in Europe, and the Reagan administration uses this as an excuse to even further step up their various plans.
And obviously, the question that we're asking is whether the counterterrorist unit was in fact the explanation, is in fact the explanation for all of these seemingly, at least on the surface, inexplicable contacts between elements of the American far right, like Oliver North, and Palestinian and ostensible left-wing terrorists, the very people that they warn us so much against and spend so much time and energy at least ostensibly trying to defend against. The question we're asking is that secret counterterrorism unit in fact a terrorism unit, a provocation unit, and does that account for all of these strange and alarming contacts that we've been looking at? We're going to take a look at three other stories indicating Reagan administration and Iran-Contra team contact with key terrorist incidents or reports of terrorist incidents within the last few years. Following story comes from the San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, January 31st of 1987. It's a Washington Post story, Dateline Washington headline, Libyan Hit Squad story called A Lie. Iranian arms broker Manuchehr Gurbanifar, allegedly a key figure in the Reagan administration's arms sales to Iran, fabricated a story in 1981 about a Libyan hit squad trying to assassinate President Reagan, according to informed sources. The hit squad intelligence, though unverified, was publicized by White House officials at the time and caused a sensation. The report by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence on the Iran-Contra affair notes that the CIA was so distrustful of Gurbanifar that it issued a warning to other government agencies in August 1984 that he was unreliable. Two knowledgeable sources said this was chiefly a reference to his role in the 1981 Hit Squad episode. One intelligence source with first-hand access to the CIA reports of the incident said, quote, though not an agency asset, Gurbanifar was a source of the Libyan Hit Squads in 1981. It was his idea, unquote. Sources said the CIA believed he was tied to both the Iranian and Israeli intelligence services and that he had made up the hit squad story in order to cause problems for one of Israel's enemies, Libya. His main motive in the arms for hostage sale, as sources said, was to make money. As a result of the report that Libyan assassins were after the president and his top advisors, security for Reagan and his cabinet was increased. U.S. officials warned Libya of grave consequences if terrorists tried to carry out their mission. Of course, what's not mentioned here is that it had the effect of whooping up political hysteria in this country and of driving the political perspective of to the right. That is, of course, the object of provocation. So once again, we have a key player or alleged player in the Iran-Contra effort involved with in this case, a fabricated terrorist incident, one which nonetheless had very real results.
I'm going to read an article from the San Jose Mercury for Sunday, December 7th, 1986. Headline, U.S. allegedly knew before arms sales that Iran paid for bombing in Beirut. The article is by Jim McGee of Knight Ridder News Service. 2 years before the clandestine shipments of American arms to Iran, the White House had precise evidence that Iran paid for the terrorist bombings in Beirut that killed 258 American servicemen and diplomats, according to information obtained by the Miami Herald and confirmed Friday by a White House official. The secret eavesdropping network of the National Security Agency intercepted diplomatic messages in 1983, showing that the government of Iran ordered and financed the bombings, the Herald learned. The intercepted diplomatic messages enabled U.S. officials to trace the movement of more than $1 million from the government of Iran to the Iranian embassy in Lebanon. There, the money was disbursed for the April 1983 bombing of the U.S. embassy, which killed 17 Americans, and the October 1983 bombing of the Marine Corps barracks at the Beirut airport, which killed 241 Americans. Quote, looking at it, the intercepted messages, after the fact, it was a clear indication the money was going for the attack, unquote, said an official familiar with reports based on the intercepts. There was no doubt in our minds. On Friday, a White House official involved in national security matters described the Herald's account of the NSA material as, quote, damn good. Quote, obviously the NSA knew about this, and I would have to surmise the president knew about it too, the White House official said. After the bombing, President Reagan took a keen interest in who did it, unquote. Skipping down to the bottom, it is not clear why the NSA intercepts were not used to warn American personnel before the attacks. One official familiar with the situation said there often are long delays in analyzing the intercept communications. We might mention that among other things going on at the same time, right at the same time as the bombings that maybe perhaps were allowed to happen in Beirut, killing 283 American Marines, the American Marines on the other side of the planet launched the attack on Grenada.
Yeah, and again, I think the notion that they had 5 days advance warning but couldn't do anything should be taken with a grain of salt. Again, the question we're asking is, were we basically looking at a terrorist incident? We're obviously looking at a terrorist incident. Were we looking at a provocation, something set up in order to produce the reaction? One of the most intriguing of all the connections between key players in the Iran-Contra scandal and terrorists was brought to light to us by a listener who sent us this clipping from the Salt Lake Tribune of Sunday, February 8th of 1987. This is a Reuters news agency story, Dateline Bonn, West Germany, headlined, Report, Hamadi and McFarlane had talks last year. Former U.S. National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane unknowingly had talks in Beirut last year with a suspected Lebanese hijacker wanted by the United States, a West German news magazine reported Saturday. Quoting U.S. security sources, it said McFarlane met the wanted man, Mohammed Ali Hamadi, H-A-M-A-D-I, while on a secret mission to seek the release of American hostages, but did not know who he was. Hamadi was arrested at Frankfurt Airport on January 13th after arriving from Beirut and is in custody in West Germany. The United States wants to try him on charges of murder and air piracy arising from the hijacking of a Trans World Airlines plane to Beirut in 1985, and the killing of an American passenger. Spiegel said McFarlane visited Beirut on the same mission that took him to Tehran to deliver arms, which it was hoped would obtain the release of the hostages. Again, I think if the West German account is true, the notion that a wanted international terrorist could possibly have had a meeting with the National Security Advisor of the United States and the security advisor did not know is absurd on its surface. Every last pore on that man would have been checked. They would have known everything about him. If indeed McFarlane did meet with him, one wonders whether it's the same sort of association we see with Messrs. Roussan, Khashoggi, Abu Nidal, Manzur Kassal, Abu Abbas, etc., etc. And again, not to beat a dead horse, the question we're asking is, are these connections for the purpose of provocation, reaction, Rex 84, and other similar type activities?
On that note, we're going to have to wrap. I think we're going to have to save our song for the next episode because we've got stuff to wrap here with. Basically, though, I think the point has been well made. I don't think it needs to be belabored. The situation is obvious on the face of it. Again, when you look at the parallels between what has already been established that the European Secret Services have done and that U.S. Secret Services have done in the past and what's going on with the Iran-Contra thing and the connections thereby obtaining between the secret team and, as Dave mentioned, Manzur al-Qasar, Abu Nidal, et al.